This is from the Midwest City Free Baptist Church.
We started a study. The main goal of the study was and is to understand how to read and interpret the Bible better. I said at the time, and obviously I still believe it, and it's always going to be true, that this is of utmost importance for all Christians. The Bible, of course, I mean, this is something I don't have to tell anyone here, but as we all know, the Bible, it is the cornerstone of our belief in terms of truth and revelation. It is the text. It is the great book of books. And even beyond this room, I mean, there are Christians all around the world. And for all of them, it's the same text that matters most. It's that same text. And for that matter, even though they don't know it, a lot of them don't know it anymore, our entire culture, the civilization we all sprang from, it was constructed on the foundations of the Bible. It is the book that all the great artists, philosophers, thinkers, and writers from most of the centuries that we've studied in school, it's the book they all knew pretty well, that they all read. So its importance, obviously, would be impossible for me to overstate for us. So shouldn't we understand it? Shouldn't we know about it and how to read it properly? So this is always important. And with that in mind, we started doing this study. And where did that take us? Well, I spent time, and I'm here, I'm just going to try to remember myself, but I spent time, I think we talked about the meaning and understanding of what it means that the Bible's inspired. Remember that? What does it mean it's inspired? What does it mean that it's the authority, it's authoritative? Then we talked a little bit about the original, how it came about. Then we spent time talking about how it was copied. You might remember that. Remember the transmission of the text. We spent time discussing that. Then we began to talk about translation, because those original copies and that were written mean nothing to you and nothing to me without it being in a language we know. As to quote Shakespeare, it's Greek to me. Right? Isn't that from Julius Caesar? It's Greek to me. I don't understand it. So it needs to be translated, and translated well. So we started to talk about translations, and we talked about some really important translations in the Latin and, you know, through time. Then we got up to English. And when we got to English, where we left off, I think we had talked about the importance of those early English translations that the modern ones are built from. Remember, Wycliffe came along and he translated, but it was from Latin. But it was still one of the early translations into English. But then came Tyndale, and he was the main figure here. Because remember, he was a real, genuine, top-notch scholar who had access to these great texts, thanks to the Renaissance, thanks to Erasmus, they were Greek texts for the New Testament, and he did just this fabulous job. Although, unfortunately for him, it was illegal. And not only did he not have permission or funding to do it, he was doing it while hiding and looking over his shoulder and all that. And eventually, sadly, of course, they caught him. He was double-crossed and they caught him. And he was executed for doing that. But his Bibles made their way into England. And they were copied and they proliferated. And the printing press had come along, so you could really crank those things out. And thanks to Tyndale, along came all these other English versions, all down the line to right now. So this is an important topic, and we'll probably end up spending 2 weeks on just this, to understand the whole landscape. You know, people today, and this includes church-going people today really don't know much about why are there different English Bibles, and what's the difference in them, and why might I use one over the others, and is one better, or are some of them bad, should I avoid some of them? I mean, these are questions that I guarantee you thousands of people going to church every week kind of wonder those things. And sometimes it's hard to find the answers. And we're not a very literate society in terms of the Bible anymore. It's similar to how nobody understands the denominations anymore. Just go out to where you work and the people you know and ask them, what the heck's the difference in a Presbyterian, and a Methodist, and a Baptist, and whatever? They don't know. They have no idea. And they may go to church, but they're just like, I just don't know. I know those are all purportedly Christian groups, but I just don't know their difference. Where they came from? Well, there was a time when people knew this a little better. Same with Bibles. You ask them, what's the difference in your KJV, your NIV, your New American Standard? They don't know. Those are just I guess those are all Bibles that I see people carrying, but I don't know the difference in them. So this topic we're now talking about really matters to people, and we could really gain some good understanding in it for our own study and our own life, but we can also help other people who want to know these things and who ask these things. So there are, of course, so many English Bibles, and this shelf in this picture has a whole lot of them. Just shows you a whole array of them. But I want to show you some things then just about English Bibles. So I got a slide here to show you just some basic things about English Bibles. Here are some facts and statistics for you. So according to the ABS, that's the American Bible Society, they estimate that there are as many as 900, and that's just a round number, 900 total English Bibles. That's just English Bibles. Different versions that are in some kind of English. Over 900 going back to, they start with Tyndale's work and they trace them on to now. That's a lot. That's every, I mean, there are so many different kind of, there are so many English Bibles you've never heard of. Some you never heard of because they were older. And some you've never heard of and they're contemporary, but they're a little different. In fact, next week, I'll show you some Bibles that'll, you'll get a kick out of some of these. There's a hillbilly version. There's a street Bible. There's an Ebonics Bible. There's a Jamaican English Bible. You know, like in the beginning, God done created the world, man. You know, that kind of thing. Yeah, you name it. There are different English Bibles of all sorts. I'll read you some passages and you'll get a real bang out of that. Obviously, it's the most of any language. There's no other language that has this many different Bibles as English has. Notice this is greater than the number of languages with a complete Bible. So the Wycliffe Bible translators, who we talk about quite a bit, and who know this kind of thing, they tell us that there are just over 670 languages that have a full Bible, a complete Bible. If you're just counting New Testament, about 1,500 languages in the world with a New Testament. Now that's because the New Testament's shorter and easier to translate and begins more with the gospel, of course. So from a Christian point of view, you're going to begin there and work your way back to the other stuff. You're not going to say, well, let's get the ball rolling with Obadiah. You know? No, you start with the gospels generally. So think about that though. Only 670 languages have a complete Bible according to their estimates. But there are a little over 900 just English versions. Of course, not all the English versions are translations. And I'll say more about that in a minute. But it just shows you that there is a certain linguistic privilege. So these days, everybody's into knowing what your privilege is. So I guess there is English. There's a language privilege. English sort of has a lot going for it. Well, there are, get this, there are some 7,000, they tell us, living languages in the world that do not have Bibles. That do not have Bibles. Now you're probably thinking to yourself, hey, hang on now. Did you just say 7,000 living languages? Because if I start thinking about languages in the world, I get to about 10, I start running out. Because I start thinking, okay, you got your English, your Spanish, your German, your French, you got your Mandarin, you got your Arabic and Hebrew, and you got your Arabic, whatever, you got the Urdu over there, and you got the people in the Korean. You might get to 20 if you really think about it. But that's a long way to 7,000. How are there 7,000? Well, you see, as you might guess, they're counting every single distinct. They might even be counting dialects. You go to some African countries, you may have, I don't know, 80 to 100 languages within that country. And we don't know anything about them. It's all foreign to us. But they know. They know that. They know the different, you know, language. So if you're counting, it adds up to a lot. So Barna says about 70, how about this, 72% of Americans, according to a survey, 72% of Americans believe that every language has a Bible. But less than half have anything more than like a fragment. Like sometimes there'll be one of these tribal languages and somebody's done a little work to give them like the Gospel of John. That's a fragment. That's like one or two books or something like that. Or just maybe a couple of Gospels in Romans, you know, or something like that, they'll give them. Or maybe they'll give them, you know, a couple of Gospels and some Psalms or something. But, so it's just interesting how that plays out. Well, We're talking about English Bibles here and contemporary English Bibles. So, I'm not sure what's next, but let's just see. I'm looking at it with you. I don't have my laptop here. This is a chart. As you know, I go to the internet, and there on the internet I find many marvelous visuals that other people made. And I say, copy, paste, right? And that's how you do that. So someone made this, and I like this, to give you a little bit of a... So up here, you see, there's your Tyndale. And this just shows you the sort of genealogy of how they're related. So after Tyndale, remember we talked about the Geneva Bible that those Protestants did who fled? You guys had that Matthew Bible, the Great Bible, called Great because it was big, the one that was chained to those pulpits, big decorative thing, Bishop's Bible. So all these were making great use of Tyndale. Like they used Tyndale's sort of brilliance to make these Bibles. They don't differ too much from them. Of course, the crown jewel of all these, the culmination of them in terms of influence, was the final. Remember, I think we spent a whole time just on one of our entire sessions, just on the King James Bible, simply because of its just the sheer magnitude and influence of the work. I mean, it's questionable whether any Bible, maybe the Latin Vulgate, but whether any Bible in any language has had the reach and the staying power, you know, of the King James. And so it's really important. So then once the King James comes along, it's such a big influential Bible that other English versions will use it. That is, they'll do their own translation, but they kind of have the King James on the side, you know, or not only on the side, a lot of translators had it in their head, you know. Imagine you sit down to translate, and even though you're a great scholar and you're translating, you spent your life maybe growing up and you hear everything in the King James. Like, by the way, some of you do. Some of you are old enough, I bet. I'm assuming it's, you know, I don't think young people are like this so much anymore. I still am to some degree. You still hear passages in their King James, even when somebody reads them in a modern translation. In your mind, is that true of some of you, right? Isn't that so? Mm-hmm. You still hear the old language in your head because you grew up hearing it so often. Some translators did that. The King James was so influential that they would hear it while they're... And so there are always echoes of it. In all these, you had the Revised Standard there in 1885, then the American Standard Version in 1901. American Standard because, you know, Americans don't speak exactly the same English as the Brits do we? That's just some different turns of phrase. We speak American. What'd you say back there?
Better.
You said better. Why, you ethnocentric bigots, you. Yeah, America! We talk gooder than them! Yeah, so you had to have an American Standard Version. Then you had the Revised Standard, the RSV, and it's been around. It still has, you will still see that one. Then they'll update those. So you have the New American Standard in 1970, and the New RSV, the New Revised Standard, in 1990. And the New King James in 1982. They're just taking the one and maybe updating the English a little, maybe because maybe some phrases change because languages are dynamic. They transition. So, now, let's move on. So, when people did translations, I want to introduce you here to the main general difference in translations. It's the big picture, broad kind of different theories of how people do translations. And most of the translations we use, I'll show you in a minute, spectrums where they fall. But different translation committees, and they're usually committees, occasionally it's one person, but usually this is done by committee. Why committee? Because in the council of many, right, there is wisdom. There's something about having more than just one mind, you know. One person, different people can see these terms and say, you know, I think it kind of reflects a little more like this. I would interpret that phrase to be emphasizing this a little more. So you get more than one good scholar together, get a committee of them. So the committees will generally operate by either this first one or this second one in terms of how they're doing it. So what are they? Well, the first one often goes by the term word for word, or a fancier term for it is formal equivalence. Formal equivalence, or word for word. Now, the features of this kind of a translation is it's a little more literal because you're You're favoring the features of the original language. What I mean features, I mean like, you know, languages have a way they go, a certain syntax and word orders and stuff. And so the Greek has certain word order. I'll show you in a second how that looks. But if you're doing this first kind, a more word-for-word type of translation, you're trying as best you can to stay as close as possible without it sounding ridiculous. To stay as close as possible to the original in terms of how the sentences are actually put together. Which the advantage of that is you feel like, oh, it's a little more literal. The disadvantage of that is the English is often not that natural sounding. So you hand one of these kind of translations, this top one, you hand it to a person who knows nothing about the Bible, an English speaker, you know, like your neighbor. And let's say they just weren't raised in church and they don't know anything. And they start reading that kind of a version, they'll notice that it has a certain sound to it that's not exactly the way everyone talks. There's a little bit of an arcane fashion to it. It's subtle, often, depending on which one you're using. But because there will be what you might call Hebraisms, you know, or there'll be Greek-like influences because they're kind of trying to follow. Now, they're not following it precisely, because then it would sound really bizarre. The only Bibles that show you that are what they call interlinear Bibles. And I'll show you a page in a minute from that. And I use one. They're great. But they're for study. They're not for reading. Because what an interlinear does is it just shows you the Hebrew or the Greek, and then underneath it, it just puts what the English is. Right? But you put all that together and try to read it like as English, and it'll sound kind of strange.
It's kind of like Spanish. If translating Spanish would read the same way. It puts certain words
right
first, and then it follows. And
right.
English has messed it all up.
Yeah. And so, you know, some translations like, for example, and I'll show you these images in a minute that show you these, but, you know, the New American Standard is trying much more to be like this. The other way you might go about a translation that a lot of these guys do is the committees might, instead of going word for word, they might choose what is often called a thought for thought type of translation. A thought for thought, which instead of formal equivalents, what they call that is dynamic equivalents. Dynamic equivalents, thought for thought. In this kind of a translation, they're interested more in good English that does actually capture what is being said in the original, but might alter the flow of the sentence so that the English sounds better, right? Their main goal is its accuracy still. You don't want to fudge on the meaning, but you won't be so tied to the way the Greek sentence is that it makes your English sound a little stilted or a little different, odd sounding or awkward. Instead, you want the English to flow nicely so that anyone could read this and that any English speaker would say, oh, I understand what these sentences are saying. But that may mean that you move the verb over and you put the noun over here to make the English sentence look better. So I'll show examples of that. And I put in an asterisk down here, just so you know, see right here? The thought for thought kind of translation does not mean I'm talking about a paraphrase. The paraphrase is its own thing. Most of those versions I mentioned to you a minute ago that we'll read next week that are kind of funny, like the Hillbilly Bible, those are all paraphrases. They are not translations. And there are some paraphrases people use. You go to any church, you probably find a paraphrase in some people's hand. And I'll say what that is in just a second. So, moving on. To show you this, here is this, remember this term interlinear, this is cut off just a little here, but interlinear Bible. Now this will look strange to you and maybe you have to strain to see it. But on this side, I just grabbed this from somewhere. On this side you've got 1 Corinthians 1:10, so this is Greek. Over here you've got Genesis 3, so that's Hebrew. And what they've done, what an interlinear Bible does, again, it's mostly for study, not for devotional reading, is it gives you what the original, what the Hebrew looks like, or over here, what the Greek looks like. The Hebrew reads the other way. Hebrew reads right to left instead of left to right. So it gives you that, and then under it, it gives you what the English letters would be to say that Hebrew word. Right? So, like, see this word here? That's these three letters, that's ba, that's Bagan. That's a B, that's a gimel in the middle, and that's the Hebrew N letter there. Bagan. So they go ahead and give it to you in English what it would sound like in Hebrew. Then what they do is they give you underneath what the kind of translating each little chunk. So maybe over here you could see it better. So you've got over here, this is anamitas, that means name. Tu means of the or of. And then kuria, Lord. See, name of. But now, so see, the interlinear is showing you that. But let's just say you said, I'll just use this and make my English out of it. Oh, everyone, join me in reading Genesis 3:10. Well, it might sound all right. I heard sound of your, and he said, and I was afraid in the garden, and so I hid myself. I for am naked, that to you he told he. You see how it's like, huh? Well, so that's because, see, you know, it just, the languages don't operate the same. In some languages, you might say, man, that language is weird. Well, it's not to people who speak it. If you switched it and they were, and a Hebrew speaker was using an interlinear that went the other way, where you took like a Declaration of Independence and you put it, then it would sound just as weird to them. Languages are different. English depends a lot on word order. English depends greatly on word order. That's why the old joke about the headline, you know, dog bites man is a normal headline. Hopefully not. But dog bites man is a normal headline. But man bites dog, now that's a real headline, right? Because notice all you did is flip, you just switched it around. In English, word order makes all the difference. But you know, in other languages, like in this Greek language here, it's an inflected language. Greek could easily have man bites dog in terms of order, but it would still mean dog bites man. Because the form of man would be in the objective. It would be, these are nouns have case. I got to go back and remember my grammar here. Mm-hmm. So it would be like in the accusative case. And whereas you would then put the nominative case, the subject of it would come at the end. But every Greek reader would know which thing's the subject because the word would change according to where it is. So I hope I'm not confusing people. I'm just trying to show this. So when they do translations, what's that?
This is daily when you translate opera.
Yeah, you have to do a lot of opera coming out of the old Latin and Italian, and well, really every
Italian,
language has
German,
it.
French,
you ever do
French.
Russian ones?
Russian, I've done Russian with
yeah.
Jagan.
Right, that's right. So that's, you got to put a little translation work into your schedule there.
Yeah.
And it's not easy. I mean, I think translators, more power to them. I mean,
it is the one thing that I hate the most.
It gives you headaches, right? You
yeah.
have to do it. So when they do it, these are some rules they do. So let me see what I got next, Aaron. I can't remember. Let me show you paraphrase examples, okay? So that you know what paraphrase means. Paraphrase means they're not necessarily trying to translate. They're trying to reword in the most. They're trying to make it as clear as possible. It's almost like they're trying to teach you what it means. So a couple of examples that I found here. So Genesis 1, the very beginning of the beginning of Genesis, look how the message, now the message is a popular paraphrase. A lot of people have the message. The message is a paraphrase. One guy did it, a guy named Eugene Peterson, and his goal was noble enough. I mean, it's to make a Bible that lots of people could understand easily. But it's not a translation, per se. Eugene Peterson didn't sit down and make us his main goal. I'm going to open up this Hebrew and make sure I get it as accurate as... That wasn't what he was going for is, I want the person on the street who never read the Bible with a fifth grade education to easily understand. So, here's how the message does Genesis, the beginning of the book. Instead of in the beginning God created, it says, first this, God created the heavens and earth. All you see, all you don't see. Earth was a soup of nothingness. A bottomless emptiness, an inky blackness. That's Shakespearean almost. An inky blackness. God's spirit brooded like a bird above the watery abyss. Now, that doesn't commit any atrocities against the text. It clarifies, but it's not a translation because these translators would never put a phrase like a bird, probably, where there's no such thing in the original. Right? God's spirit moved on the face of the waters, but like a bird, it's explanatory. It's kind of poetic, but it's not. There's nothing like that in the original, so a translator would probably not include it. But a paraphrase, You know, look, we paraphrase all the time. I paraphrase on the spot lots when I'm preaching. I'll be like, here, you know, we read 1 Peter, whatever, and then I'll say something like, what Peter's basically saying there is, and everything, you know what I mean? He's basically saying, hey, you guys, and see, now I'm paraphrasing when I do that. I'm telling you in other words what he, and that's, all the paraphrases are, is somebody doing that all the way through. That's basically what that is.
That's what the news media does.
Right, yeah. Yeah. The news media should do more good translation of what's going on and less of their own paraphrasing. Because paraphrasing does include more editorializing. It really does. When you paraphrase, you're there's more of you in it. John 1:12. But as many as received him, this is the King James, to them gave he. Notice that gave he the power, or gave he power. See, normal English would say he gave power. Now that's old English anyway, but... to them gave he power to become the sons of God, even to them that believe in his name. What does the message do? But whoever did want him, who believed he was who he claimed, and would do what he said, he made to be their true selves, their child of God selves. Now, occasionally I find things in the message that I just can't stand. I'll be like, ugh, man, that's painful. Painful to read the way he did it. But overall, I don't necessarily have a beef with what he did. He meant very well, and it can be useful to people. But I would encourage a seasoned Christian to utilize a translation and not the message, unless you want to use the message on the side. I mean, I would say, you really want to study the Bible well, I consult it sometimes to see, because I'm curious what a paraphrase might say about something. But certainly I wouldn't come saying, I have carefully studied this passage in 1 Corinthians on tongues to understand the doctrine better. By which I mean, I read it out of the message. That's the extent of my study. No. If all you did is read that passage in the message, you didn't do much due diligence to study it. You know, so that's what I mean by paraphrase. Well, let us move on to whatsoever I have next. So here are some things that people have provided us to show us where different translations and versions fall on the spectrum. I got a few of these, but look at this, what someone did here. This is a spectrum. This end is more word-for-word style, what I told you formal equivalence. This end is more thought-for-thought style, or what I call dynamic equivalence. And look at where the different translations fall on it. So, look, the far tip of word-for-word is what I showed you, interlinear. An interlinear is definitely the most rigidly word for word, because it's literally trying to just do it that, right? But look where, remember I said the NASB, the New American Standard, is pretty far over? Well, they put it here. I often use the ESV. It's still pretty far over, according to them. The RSV, the New King James. The Holman Bible is closer to the middle. Now, if you go way over to the thought-for-thought side, you get the paraphrases. They put them along this spectrum. I might put them outside of the spectrum, but see the message. And the Living Bible is another. The Living Bible was for many years the most popular paraphrase, and it still may be. I don't know. But you've got the Amplified Bible, you've got the Message, and some others. The Contemporary English Version. Notice the NIV. It's interesting. They put the NIV, which is a very popular, extremely popular Bible. They put the NIV square in the middle. Like it gets the most centrist position. Now this is, again, all these are somebody's. I didn't make these. So I'm sure people might debate, oh, that one should be over more, this one should be over. But it's just interesting to see, isn't it, where people put these. So I have more. So Aaron just got taller back there. So show me the next one. So here's another one. This one's hard to read down here. Sorry about that. But they do the same thing. But what they do is they say word for word on this end, thought for thought more in the middle, and they put paraphrase on its own way over here. So look at the messages even. The message is way over here. I suspect the Living Bible would be over here too if they didn't list it. But they still put interlinear way over here, New American Standard. Yeah, they look similar, doesn't it? And they give you the help of all these, the key here to show you what else. Actually, you know what? They do have the Living Bible. I'm sorry. TLB is what they call it. TLB, the Living Bible. So there you go. What's the joke that Jim never can resist making about how Well, he was tested and he's NIV positive. What is that? What? I don't know what. What's the setup? That's the punchline. He's NIV positive? Anyway. All right, show me the next one.
As another one like it, this one's easier to see. So here you have what they call interlinear, then more formal, then more functional, and then free, whatever that is. So over here, paraphrase style, you got, and they put earlier form, later form. So they're showing you like some that were earlier and ones that are newer, right? So earlier ones that are more on the formal side are the King James, the New American Standard, the RSV. Newer ones are New King James, ESV, you know, and the Holman on that side. Over here, older paraphrase was Living Bible, newer paraphrase, the Message. Older Bibles that were more functional or dynamic equivalent, NIV, New American Bible, the JB, that I think that's maybe also the Phillips Bible. And then newer ones in IV 2011, they updated it. So the New Jerusalem Bible, that probably is, I think. So you see, you can even find more of these, by the way, of people kind of showing you those differences. And this helps you, I think, because what this does is it gives us an ability to sort of understand all these Bibles. And remember, I said in the beginning, this is something a lot of Christians just don't understand. And some of them are scared of, some of them are made nervous by the fact that there are so many Bibles. Like, oh my gosh, there's so many of them. Maybe that means I'm reading the wrong one. Maybe I'm being misled. And there are kooky people who have said before that, you know, you got to watch who you read, by the way. I won't say much about this. I think I mentioned it when we spent our night on the King James Bible. I mentioned that there are some extremely devoted zealots who are almost part of us. You're almost called a cult. Who are the KJV only. And they are so hardcore about it that their religion is almost KJVism. And I've met them, by the way. When I lived in Texas for a while, there was this church I always had to pass by. This was years ago. May not even be there. And that's what they were. They were like a King James Bible church. And that's all they did. All their sign always, their sign, every time you passed it, their little sign, would have something about how evil the new translations are. And they would actually send out the young men wearing suits with megaphones to tell people in traffic, stop, don't read the devil's translations. And then every year they had a King James only conference, like a week-long conference on the topic. And when I was in Salt Lake, I'd go down there and see how it was going with people like my friend Rob that you heard from. I'd be down there talking to people. Well, these guys, there were these other group that would show up down there at the temple. They were the King James only guys. And they're like, what are you doing here? Well, they were down there to argue with the other Christian people. So yeah, they're hard. The King James only people, some of them are really, really hard to deal with. They're just, you know, they just believe that the King James basically was gilded and, you know, gold plated up in heaven above. The Lord wrote it with his own hand at his own desk. And then he dropped it down out of the sky. So, it's the only one for me. So yeah, that can be a problem. So some people can be misled by that. And then some people can just be nervous because they say, I'm nervous, there's so many Bibles. But look, it's good to know these things. What, are you trying to get revenge on me now? Did someone tell you what I did earlier?
Yes.
Oh, how'd you find out? Who told you?
Harold Bishop.
Harold, how could you? Don't you tell stories on him. I know he's lips are sealed. So yeah, I knew I was hoping no one would tell you so you wouldn't get revenge on me. Actually, I didn't realize that Jim brought that other one that has the... So we're having like laser pointer wars now? But just for the record, I killed you like 25 minutes ago, so... You're a dead man walking back there! So, anyway, but revenge is sweet. I don't know if I have any more slides. See if I do. They were all just this. I'll give you this one here. So, based on quantitative... You can't see the top of this got cut off, but it was trying to show you one side was English readability, and one side was formal, literally sticking to the text. What should you do, though? So you think, what should I do? What should I read? I think there's nothing wrong with having more than one. You know, there's an app. There's that app that I think the Life Church people came up with. It's pretty cool. What's it called? It's just Gateway. I have it. I don't remember what it was called. There's like all kinds of Bibles on that thing. So there's nothing wrong, especially these days with the apps, how easy it is. So I'm not having to tell. It's not like I'm telling people, if you're going to study the Bible, you got to run out and buy 6 translations. Oh man, I think that's a lot of money. Well, now you can just get 6 apps. But there's nothing wrong with using. It's a good idea. Use more than one. That's why sometimes in sermons, every once in a while, if there's a passage that I know it's a tricky one, and translators went some different ways on it, I just show you all of them. I figure I don't want anyone to think, hey, how come you went with that one when this other one says it's a little different? I just throw them all to you and say, see this? That's very rare, by the way. Most passages are a little more straightforward. But occasionally the translators, like, you know, they're sawing through the log and they hit a knot. You know what I mean? It's like, ooh, this one's a real doozy. And then they come up with a few differences. And in those settings, it's really nice and helpful to have more than one translation to see what it is.